Surge forward. We are in the fourth chapter of part one, 646-1. So Teresa's talking about these different kind of visions, the imaginative visions and intellectual visions. And she's talking about intellectual visions in this part here. She says, in regard to intellectual visions, she does not understand how they can be remembered, but she does know that some truths about the grandeur of God remain so fixed in the soul that even if faith were not to tell it who God is and of its obligations to believe that he is God, from that very moment it would adore him as God, as did Jacob when he saw the ladder. So in these intellectual visions, she doesn't understand how they work, really. They just happen. And so she doesn't understand the mechanism of how all that happens. But when it does happen, you never forget what you learned when you have this vision. Yeah.
To me, my deep theological term, vision and teaching is sort of, a vision is something you see. The intellectual is that you get this knowledge of God instantly. So you don't see the knowledge.
No.
It comes in. Well, then why do they call it a vision? Why don't they just say it's divine inspiration?
You'd have to ask Teresa that. That's what she calls it.
That's confusing.
Yeah, it is.
Jim, where are we? I think I brought my wrong ones. What page are
we? Are on page 20 of part one. Yeah. I broke them up because they have so many chapters in these things, you know.
I got part two with me.
Part two will be started later. You have part one?
Not with me. It must be sitting. I thought this was part one, but this is the sixth dwelling place.
It is the sixth dwelling place, part one.
Yeah.
But wait, it just says place, sixth dwelling place?
Contains 11 chapters.
Yeah, okay. Go to page 20.
Yeah.
Got it? All right. We're in shape. We're in good shape here.
Sorry, I'm so slow.
Elaine's back with us now. So, good. So she's talking about these intellectual visions. She calls them visions because even though you don't see something either with the eyes of the soul or your physical eyes, it's like God is right there. She talks about it as if you sense Jesus right next to you, like he's walking along with you, and he's talking to you. Although you don't turn and look and see him, you have this certainty that he's right there. And it's one of the ways that he teaches us. And when you go through these things, the teaching is like almost instantaneous. They don't last that long, but they just communicate the essence of what God is or what you are. He teaches you about yourself sometimes, not just about him. But it's always about the relationship between you and him. And that's the big thing.
Well, a person can get a sense of God. You can get a sense of God that he's here. Like, really, sometimes I get it. Ooh, he's right here. But you don't get instruction or knowledge. You just get a sense, a strong sense he's there.
Yeah, but with these things you do.
Yeah.
So he's giving you infused knowledge through these special visions. Mm. And it's teaching you about him and about you. And each time he takes you into this experience, he's teaching you something else that you didn't know before. Mm-hmm. He doesn't keep teaching you the same thing over and over again. I know we're not the brightest things in the world compared to him, but he does teach us different things each time. And you don't forget it. Mm. That's the other thing she says about these visions, that you don't forget it. And there's a certitude associated with them. You absolutely know that this is true when he gives it to you. And that's what she's talking about. She gives the example of Jacob in the ladder, you know, that he was absolutely certain that he had encountered God, even though he couldn't see who he was wrestling or anything else, you know. So she says, in intellectual visions, God teaches about himself and about heaven in such a way that what is learned sticks even though the soul cannot explain how it happens. So we don't understand the mechanism by which he infuses knowledge into our souls. He just does. And does it really matter? No. As long as you have the knowledge, you know, that's the only thing that's really important. It doesn't matter the mechanism. It's the fact that he does give you this knowledge that does stick and you don't forget it. And that's really good for me, because I forget everything. So if I ever have one of these things, I'll be able to stick it forever, you know. And that's really good, because I walk from one room to the next one, and why I walk to that room, you know.
Yes, yeah, it's hard.
You know, those kind of things.
It gets worse, too.
Yeah. Yeah, I go in the morning, take my morning pills, and I have my glass of water. Then I walk back into the kitchen, forget the glass on the table, you know.
I forget the pills I took.
Yeah.
It's like, I leave them here, because I got so many. My daughter's in that company. I got so many, I don't take them all. And I put them all here. So now I have the ones I take, I put to the left, because I don't remember. I can't remember which ones I took.
Well, I can't either. So I have these little pill things, and I fill the little holes with the ones for the day, you know. And so otherwise, I'll forget which ones I took.
Kind of like the guy who said, my wife says I only have two main problems. One is I don't listen to her, and something else.
Yeah.
Right. Yep. I saw a t-shirt with that on it. I don't think I got that one. So do you think intellectual visions are like inspiration, where the idea of knowledge just happens, but you can't explain how, or is it something other than inspiration?
I just got an email this morning. I think it's Formed, you know, that thing.
Yeah, right.
And it was talking about how to know if, how to hear God. And so the guy wrote, I don't know what it was, wrote how he knows in his mind. And it makes me think of this, because he says, you know, you have these thoughts pop up in your head. How do you know that's not just you pushing it? Mm. And he said, well, in the morning, you get up and you start thinking, okay, I got to do this, this, and this. That's you pushing the thoughts of your day.
Right.
And then in between it, there's some little, I guess, random thing that pops up.
Yeah.
And that, he says, that's God.
It's a pop-up.
Yeah.
It's a pop-up.
Yeah. It's like a gentle suggestion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't know if that was the word, but it's in there. And then, because he says, you know, you're praying that you can hear God and what he's saying, you should be praying that you, he's already, you know, you're praying that, well, God talk to you. And he's saying he probably is. Your prayer should be, you know, help me to figure it out.
Right.
Yeah. So it's interesting.
Yeah, it is interesting. So God works in a lot of different ways with us. Yeah. And this is just one way. But for those of us who are not having these kind of things, he still talks to us. Like Elaine was just saying, you know, he'll give you some kind of a indication of what he wants you to think about, pray about, anything like that, you know.
Inspiration, something. You get an inspiration to do something good or something. That's of course from God. But to me, an intellectual vision would be more a teaching.
Yeah.
God gives you that direct knowledge about something.
About
inspiration
himself,
is more he gives you a thought to do something.
Right.
Okay. How do I know it's God's voice?
Yeah.
Father, Mark, whatever.
My wife gives me inspirations, too. You know, I want you to do this. And I walk out the house and forget, you know. She's very inspiring. She'll call me later. Did you do what I told you to do, you know?
Sometimes, you know, you have these complicated problems. I think it happens every holiday. How are we going to see these people? How are we going to fit in and see our family, take care of elderly?
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, I'll just go, I got a brainstorm. And it answers all of it. And I'm thinking, that's probably not me.
Never know. You never know, you know. So in 648... Teresa continues to try to explain the intellectual vision. She's having a hard time explaining to her little nuns what these things are and how they work, because they just happen to her, but she doesn't understand the mechanism, you know. So she continues to try to explain the intellectual vision and tries to do so by comparison to things of this earth. She says they're like this or like that. So she speaks of a room full of treasures that she once saw. And she went to visit somebody's house, and they had this room full of all these things. and likens the experience to that. She says she saw everything at once, but could not recall a single piece in detail. Likewise, with this favor, the soul, while it is made one with God, is placed in this room of the imperial heaven that we must have interiorly. But clearly the soul has some of these dwelling places since God abides within it. So she's saying she went to this house full of these treasures. And then she said, well, we must have something like that in our soul, because God is dwelling in our soul. And so when he calls us to himself, we see these treasures that he then gives us an inspired knowledge of, but we can't pick them apart. We can't look at them individually and say, well, this is this thing and this is this thing. They just kind of all come together at one time. And that's kind of interesting. So she's really struggling, trying to help us get our heads wrapped around it. So, is Teresa saying that a soul in this state of grace is drawn into a connection with heaven, but within the interior of the soul? It sounds like the answer is yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What was it? St. Elizabeth the Trinity, she said. Like, heaven is in my soul or something. She said, you just have to, like, when she went interiorly, she said, you step into heaven, like you're in heaven.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hmm. So it seems that heaven is not some place we go, like a different country or something like that, but it's a different state of being. Hmm. And you can have that state within your soul, if God is within your soul, because it's wherever he is.
Sanctifying grace.
Yeah, because it's wherever he is.
Yeah. Her life was on EWTN Saturday night.
It was.
Oh, it was mind-boggling.
I wish I'd seen it.
It was. Because you went into the convent in the present day, and a nun was speaking, but you did see snippets of her life.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing.
Yeah, she was quite a brilliant woman.
And they said she was a saint. They knew when she went in the convent, the nun said, this postulant is a saint. They knew.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So Teresa begins in this 649-1. She begins by saying that if at times in its raptures the soul doesn't understand these secrets, its raptures are not given by God, but caused by some natural weakness, but not by the devil. So you think you're going through a rapture, but you don't understand what God is telling you. So it's not real knowledge. You just think you have this impression of something that you don't understand, and it probably doesn't stick either, because the other ones always said they stick. But his raptures are not given by God, but caused by some natural weakness. To her, natural weakness could be anything from a mental disturbance. Because you hear people all the time talking about, you know, like with the guy that just did the shooting. You remember?
Mm-hmm.
Recently he said he heard these mm-hmm.
voices
in his head.
Mm-hmm. Was this up in Maine?
Yeah.
Did they finally catch him?
Oh, yeah.
He was found dead. He killed himself.
Oh. Yeah.
Yeah, they found him dead.
Yeah.
But in the news, it talked about how he was hearing these voices in his head. I guess they were telling him to do these kind of things. Mm-hmm. And he couldn't resist it. And then he finally killed himself. And
remember Son of Sam, New York?
Yep.
I remember that. He said he heard.
There's a lot of experimentation going on with what are called ELF waves, extreme low frequency.
Yeah.
Because they're on the same wavelength as our brain. So there's a lot of that. I think that's one of the reasons there's so much craziness going on right now.
It could be. There's a lot of that going on.
Yes. Yeah.
But she says they're not given by God, and it probably because you don't remember them either.
Mm-hmm.
So the quote from her says, in a rapture, believe me, God carries off for himself the entire soul. So he's bringing the soul to him in this rapture. And as to someone who is his own and his spouse, he begins showing it some little part of the kingdom it has gained by being espoused to him. However small that part of his kingdom may be, everything that there is in it, this great God, everything that there is in this great God is magnificent. So whatever he shows you about himself is magnificent. There's nothing about him that's not magnificent. And he doesn't want any hindrance from anybody, neither from the faculties nor from the senses. But he immediately commands the doors of all these dwelling places to be closed, and only that door to his dwelling place, number 7, remains open so that we can enter. So he's now bringing you into this very intimate communication with himself. He's saying, come to me, be with me here, right in front of me, and I'm going to infuse knowledge of myself right into your soul. That's got to be a pretty amazing experience.
Yeah. So deep, you can't even fathom it.
Yeah, I mean, just think about, you know.
I was thinking this morning, after communion, it's not funny, but we consume the body and blood of Christ.
Right.
When you think of it.
Yeah.
We're chewing. We're eating. It's like...
Yeah.
You can't even go there. It's like...
And you feed your soul.
It's... Yeah. When you really think of it.
Yeah, it's amazing.
That's what a lot of people try to do, is they try to understand it in physical. And
yeah.
You can't.
It's not a physical thing.
You can't. The mind can't. I was that. I thought the mind
Jesus,
can absorb.
Jesus hinted at it when he said, unless you eat my flesh and drink my blood, you have no life in you.
Yeah.
And so when you receive the Eucharist, you're receiving his divine life into your soul. So he's communicating the divine life of the Trinity into your soul. So you begin to participate in the divine life of the Trinity while you're still here.
That's mind-boggling.
But you don't know, until you get to where she was, you don't always sense it. Because if you did sense it, it'd make you too prideful. You know, and you'd lose all the benefits of it. So he gives you the grace of it without putting you in jeopardy, you know, which is very nice of him to do that, you know. Thank you.
Do other saints express their raptures in a similar way that she does?
Some of them do. Ignatius Loyola talked about some of the raptures he went through. And he talks about him like, he mentioned something about when he was saying Mass, when he got to the consecration. He talks about what he felt in the consecration. Mm-hmm. And in his case, it made him cry a lot. He talks about copious tears while he's offering Mass. And they're not tears of sadness, they're tears of just the immensity of the experience, you know. The love and everything else that God is sharing when that happens. And so it would take him a long time to say Mass. Padre Pio was the same way. He would say the Latin Mass then, and it was a low Mass. He didn't like high Masses because he didn't like all the singing and stuff, you know. He just wanted to have a nice low Mass to do the. But it would take him 3 hours to say a low Mass, which for most priests would take at the most a half an hour, maybe 20 minutes.
Yeah.
But he would spend so much time at the consecration. And he said, when I consecrate the Eucharist, my heart is in sync with the heart of Jesus so closely that the Blessed Mother herself can't tell us apart.
Oh,
wow.
So,
well, for some reason, they weren't going to let him become a priest, right?
No, he became a priest, but they would let him hear confessions for 3 years. One of the greatest confessors the church has ever had, because they said he didn't know enough about moral theology. He had to study moral theology a little better. He could read souls, you know. I
mean? They said the same thing about St. John Vianney, didn't they?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it just boggles your mind to think of something like that, you know.
That's kind of what Eleanor was referring to. You can understand things in the physical, but then there's a whole spiritual realm.
Yeah,
sure. Mind-boggling.
Outside of us.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Teresa's saying that God does not want to lose the soul, so he's really getting jealous. You know, we say our God is a jealous God. Jealousy means you want to keep what you have. If you want what somebody else has, that's envy, and that's a vice. But God is a jealous God because once he has our souls, he wants to keep them. He doesn't want anything to take them away. And so that's kind of what he's doing here. He does not want to lose the soul, does not want the soul to regress once he has brought it to betrothal with himself, so he closes the doors to regression. Mm-hmm. He doesn't let you go backwards, you know, once you get to this point, which is nice to know.
Yeah.
If you ever get there, it's you feel safe. Whew, I made it, you know. There yet.
Well, since you have free will, he must just overwhelm you with grace that you just wouldn't think of.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of like in heaven, you know, the angels have free will too. But they made a choice at one point.
Mm-hmm.
And then once they made that choice, that was it, you know.
Mm.
And that's what he wants from us. He wants us to make that choice for him and not change that choice.
Mm.
To want him more than we want anything else. 6:4, 12, and 13. Teresa, speaking of the blessing given in this dwelling place, says, even though it is true that these are blessings the Lord gives to whomever he wills, his majesty would give them all to us if we loved him as he loves us. So now she's saying that we can achieve this only through love. But we have to love enough. And he would give all the blessings if we loved him as much as he loves us. But we can't ever do that, right? Because he loves us with an infinite love, and none of us are infinite. But if we loved him completely and above all else, we'd come close. And we could probably do that.
Well, he would have to give you the grace to love that.
Give you the grace. Because everything comes from his grace, right? So in section 13, Teresa describes the effects in the body when this kind of rapture takes place. The body functions seem to be suspended, and the body doesn't seem to have any life. Nevertheless, so extreme an ecstasy doesn't last long. So these are really extreme experiences. They don't last long, but they accomplish so much in the short time that they do exist. I'm glad the body functions seem to be suspended, because I would not have to worry about having to go to the bathroom when this happens, right? That's always a danger. Yeah, whenever I go somewhere, I always look at where's the nearest bathroom, you know. Go to Costco, where is it? Yeah. That's always a...
So you hope that your experience like that doesn't happen in Costco.
Yes, right. So are you aware of instances where this kind of ecstasy seems to take place? You ever have anything like that?
Would that be where saints levitate?
Yeah, I was kind of thinking of that.
Teresa levitated.
Joseph of Pepper.
Quite a few. Yeah.
I don't know who else did. John Bosco? I don't want to.
Oh, Peregrine.
What?
Isn't St. Peregrine lifted off the cross?
Oh, yeah.
In the church, the stained glass window?
Oh, yeah.
Cupertino.
Cupertino.
Yeah, he levitated all the time.
Hmm. So it has happened. And you see hints of it when you look at the girls in Garabandal, when they went through their experiences of rapture. You know, these big strong men tried to pick this little girl up and they couldn't pick her up.
Wow.
It was like trying to pick up a 1,000-pound stone, you know.
Mm.
And yet they could run backwards, looking up at the sky without ever tripping or stumbling or anything like that.
I'm thinking of Bernadette. I think when they were testing her, they put one of the other saints, they put something in front of her eyes like fire, and she never blinked or never moved or something.
And her pupils never dilated.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, they do all kind of tests on the kids like that. So in section 14, Teresa describes the effect this has on the body when it returns to its senses. So you go through this experience and then you come back to yourself, and then what's that like? So the will remains so absorbed and the intellect so withdrawn for a day and even days that the latter seems incapable of understanding anything that doesn't lead to awakening the will to love. And the will is wide awake to this love and asleep to becoming attached to any creature. Mm. So the result of this in your body is that your love for God grows to the point of exclusion of almost anything and everything else. You have this experience. You encounter infinite love in a very intimate way. And that has an effect on you. You know, think about it, it would almost have to have, you know, when you have this kind of thing.
That would be weird if you're in a marriage situation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, maybe that's why it happens.
Let me know when you get close, Mary Lou.
But I think God would account for that if that did happen.
Yeah.
You know, because he brought you together in the first place.
Right, right.
And united through him.
Right.
So I don't think it would interfere with that.
Yeah.
But your whole relationship with God changes. Mm-hmm. I mean, right now we kind of go through life and we go to Mass and we go to communion and we, you know, we read and we do this kind of stuff. But that kind of thing would be very different.
Yeah.
Very different. So Teresa says, in 15 and 16, the strength of love makes the soul feel all that is done amounts to little, and see clearly that the martyrs did not accomplish much in suffering the torments that they did, because with this help from our Lord, such suffering is easy.
That's what I'm hoping the hostages are having.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, God is merciful.
Yeah, you'd hope so.
Yeah.
So this strength of love, she said, it makes the soul feel that all that is done amounts to nothing. So whatever suffering you're having amounts to nothing. But he's doing something more here, it sounds to me like, when she's talking about this. She says, the mortals did not accomplish much in suffering the torments they did, because with this help from the Lord, such suffering is easy. When you look at what they suffered, none of that was easy.
Right. You know? Do you remember when ISIS crucified that little girl, that 10-year-old girl, and she was saying the Our Father from the cross, and she didn't show any pain at all? So I think that would be an experience
of this. Yeah. Right. So you would see these things. Like, you hear stories like St. Lawrence. Mm-hmm. When they were barbecuing him, he says, well, I'm done there, turn me over, you know.
I mean, that's the most famous quote.
if you're the one turning the spit and you hear him say something like that, that has to affect you at your core. You know, I mean, gee, many crickets. Just think about that, you know. With all the saints that were sent to the lions, you know.
Yeah.
And those kind of things that...
They had to behead them because they wouldn't suffer the burning or whatever.
Yeah, all those kind of things.
I thought Joan of Arc, I don't know.
Yeah.
They say she didn't feel the fire. Heard that or read. I don't know if that's true.
Well, she might have just been overcome by smoke inhalation too before anything else.
Yeah.
But Maximilian Kolbe, they tried to kill him all kind of ways and they couldn't do it.
Yeah.
So they finally just dispatched him, you know. But God worked in these saints to keep them from having to suffer the suffering that the way we would suffer if it happened to us right now would be really amazing.
Yeah, same with St. Isaac Jogues. They chewed his fingers and he went back.
Oh. Yeah. Yeah.
Is that Lucy with the eyes? She has the eyeballs in her hand?
Yeah.
Who is that?
St. Lucy.
Oh. There was a statue of her.
Yes, she's patron saint of eye problems.
Oh.
It's amazing. So she affects describes the effect it has on her body, and it causes so much love that the will is wide awake to the love that you have for God, and asleep to becoming attached to any creatures. And that's interesting. So, if you have a pet dog, do you stop loving your dog? You don't love a dog, right? You just appreciate a dog, but you don't love them. Love is a different thing altogether.
I don't know. Some people get pretty close.
They dress them up like people.
Yeah. So this encounter with God is so powerful, it absorbs the mind and the soul. Consider how it must be after multiple such experiences. Then think of what it must have been like to be Padre Pio. You know, when he was always having these experiences by location and all the rest of the stuff he did. You know, having Jesus as a playmate when you're 5 years old and thinking everybody else has it too. And not understanding that it's not a common thing. Yeah.
If God didn't do that for him, he would just want to be in heaven all the time.
Yeah.
He probably couldn't stand this world.
Yeah.
So he had to keep.
Yeah, he is an amazing man. Wow. Did you know that when he died, his stigmata disappeared?
Yeah.
As he was dying, all the wounds disappeared. I got this book at home. It was on his about his beatification process. And in there it talks about what happened to him as he was dying. And he has photographs showing the progression of the wounds and how they just gradually disappeared as he died. It's really amazing.
I think Father Bruce had that.
He does have it, yeah.
And his are not very well.
Yeah, his disappeared too. I heard that. Yeah, I've never met him.
I never heard of him. Our Lady of the Blue Ridge
Arlington
one
priest.
Sunday.
Oh, really?
He cut out 45 minutes at the end of Mass and just talked with us.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, he's interesting. His parents lived in Stafford, I think in Acquire Harbor. They had a statue of the Blessed Mother, and that statue would weep.
Really?
Yeah. So his parents are probably pretty holy too, you know.
Yeah.
Okay. So 15 and 16, Teresa says the strength of love makes the soul feel all that is done amounts to little and see clearly that the martyrs did not accomplish much in suffering their torments. So all that is done amounts to little. So we, regardless of what she's doing, whatever work she's doing, she doesn't see it as really accomplishing much of anything. Even though it's doing God's work, she doesn't see it as a big monumental, you know, accomplishment or anything because of what she's experiencing. The real monumental accomplishment of your life is union with God. So all those things lead up to that. Everything we do in our lives leads up eventually to that experience, which is permanent if you're in heaven. So when this favor is granted them in secret, their esteem for it is great. When it is given in the presence of other persons, their embarrassment and shame are so strong that the pain and worry over what those who saw it will think somehow takes the soul away from what was being enjoyed. And she had that happen several times. She talks about it in one of her books where some kind of famous person was there wanting to meet her because she was getting kind of a reputation, a good reputation, not a bad reputation. And they wanted to meet her, and she was talking to him, and she felt it coming on. And she said, "Oh no, not now." she was so funny.
Was it her that she asked the other sisters to hold her down?
When she was going to levitate, she said, "Just sit on me, hold me down. You know, don't let anybody see this happening." Well, I could see where it would freak you. I mean, if you're like a royalty or something, and you go to meet her and she's all of a sudden rising off the ground, that would kind of freak you out, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, you know,
because they think she was crazy or possessed because, you know, possessions, the stuff flies around.
Yeah. So anyway, she didn't want anybody to know that was going on. For these persons, know the malice of the world, and they understand that the world would not perhaps regard the experience of what it is, but that what the Lord should be praised for will perhaps be the occasion for rash judgments. In other words, they'll make false conclusions as to what's really going on. In some ways, it seems to me that this pain and embarrassment amount to a lack of humility. For if this person desires to be reviled, what difference does it make what others think? So she's afraid that that you're worried about what other people think, but if you're truly experiencing this with the right attitude, that you think less of yourself and more of God, you don't care what anybody thinks. So don't worry about what other people think. You should always feel that way anyway. You know, as long as you know you're doing the right thing, who cares? Do you think a person who is actually lacking in humility will be able to advance to this state?
No.
I don't see how.
No.
I don't see how. Because when God's doing this with you, He's really accomplishing what Jesus said, you know, imitate me, for I am meek and humble of heart. So He's bringing you into a state of being where you're actually imitating Him to an extreme degree. And if that's the case, then you couldn't possibly lack humility. Mm-hmm. Especially when you, like He says, when you come out of it, you realize how great God is and how little you are, and how you don't have a lot of esteem for anything you do because it's so minuscule compared to what God does, especially what He does in you.
I don't think it would happen unless you'd already arrived at a good measure of what you're talking about.
I think so too. Yeah, I think so. So it goes back to, you know, at the very beginning, she mentions that throughout this entire book, the two things you come back to all the time are self-knowledge and humility. Humility has to be maintained. The minute you lose that, queen of all the virtues, right? The minute you lose that, you tend to lose everything else. So you have to maintain that humility. Teresa then says, it seems that our Lord wishes all to understand that the soul is now His, that no one should touch it, for if the soul does not withdraw from the spouse through a very culpable boldness, He will protect it from the whole world and even from all of hell. So once you are there and you are His spouse, you belong to Him. And unless you, through your own volition, choose to move away from Him, which I can't imagine anybody ever doing, but I guess it's possible, He's going to protect you and keep you and not let you get away.
So most of these people who have been on this path to have this experience, I would imagine they would have been really assaulted by the demonic before they started springboarding toward Christ, and is totally within His protection.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, because He goes after those that are striving more than.
Sure.
Yeah.
So that's the first four chapters of six. We now get into to section two. And I think I gave my section two to somebody else.
Here's a part two.
Two? Let me start off here. Yeah, part two. Okay. This will be chapter five. And we'll get into this a little bit for the rest. So in this chapter, chapter 5, Teresa speaks about another kind of rapture where the Lord raises up the soul through a flight of the Spirit. And when you read this, one of the first, at least the first thing that came to my mind was the experience of St. John writing the book of Revelation, where he says, I was caught up in the Spirit up into the heavens. And so it's that kind of thing where you feel like you're coming out of your body and going somewhere else. Like you're, bilocating or something like that, like Padre Pio would do.
St. Paul experienced that too, also, didn't he?
Yeah. And so this is another way of experience of rapture that she's talking about, where you where you actually seem to leave your body and go somewhere else.
But if you go into this experience with that as your end goal, I just want to fly, then that kind of negates.
Yeah, it does. Yeah. And she said, I think she said earlier that if you try to make these things happen, they won't happen. You know, it's not something you can do. It's something God has to do with you and for you. Just, you cannot do anything to cause it to happen. And she also says that people can progress all the way to the seventh dwelling place without any of these experiences happening. You don't have to go through any of this to get there.
I'm thinking of the Saint Teresa, the Therese.
Yeah. A little flower.
Yeah, she's pretty opposite, but...
Yeah.
Yeah.
But she got there.
Yeah.
So, that's just something to keep in mind, that you don't have to have all these experiences in order to get to that final dwelling place. So, Teresa calls this rapture a flight of the spirit. She says, this rapture, though substantially the same as other raptures, is interiorly experienced very differently. She spoke about this difference in some detail in the book of her life in chapters 18 and 20 and in her spiritual testimonies, chapter 59. So if you have any of those books, you can look in there in these chapters and see what she says about that. Teresa describes it as a sudden movement of the spirit. She says, for sometimes, suddenly a movement of the soul is felt so swift that it seems the spirit is carried off at a fearful speed, especially in the beginning. So evidently she experienced this several times, and the first time it seemed to her she was really traveling fast, but then after it happened a few times she got kind of used to it, and that she didn't have this speed thing impressing her as much as it did the first time. So I can imagine what that would feel like. Where am I going? Where am I going?
I mean, I'm surprised she doesn't think like she died. Your body's not going with you. It's just your spirit.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. So Teresa describes it as a sudden movement of the spirit. She says, so swift that it seems the spirit carried off. She also describes the kind of surprise the soul experiences, especially at the beginning. She says, do you think it's a small disturbance for a person to be very much in his senses and see his soul carried off? And in this case of some, we have read even the body with the soul, without knowing where that soul is going, what or who does this or how. At the beginning of this swift movement, there is not so much certitude that the rapture is from God. So the first time it happens to you, what's going on? Because you don't know if it's God doing it to you or not. And you're getting this rapture thing that's going off, and you say, whoa, what's going on? You know?
So the soul goes by itself.
It could.
Yeah.
And she says sometimes your body goes with it. You know?
Well, would that be what people experience when they have a near-death experience? Usually speed involved with that? I forget.
I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know.
But again, with all these kinds of things she's talking about, there's a purpose to it. God doesn't just do this for the fun of it. He doesn't say, I'm going to go grab Mary Voss today, and I'm going to throw her up into some, seventh heaven or something like that.
Never know, Mary.
Yeah.
Can't do too much until he loses a few pounds.
Yeah. Yeah. God doesn't play tricks on us. He does not play tricks on us. So he's doing it for a purpose, and the purpose is always to communicate himself to us. And so that's the beauty of the whole thing. He's giving us a better understanding of him, a greater knowledge of him. And why would he want to do that? For one reason. The more we know about him, the more we can love him.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Everything goes back to love. Love is the central thing for everything. What Teresa describes is similar to what St. John describes at the beginning of Revelation, and then describes what he sees and what he hears. And this In the case of St. John, there was a clear purpose and intent for what he experienced because Jesus told him what that purpose is. He says, write down, record everything you see and hear. Yeah. Obviously for us. So that was the purpose. So there's always a purpose to what God does. Always. St. Paul also speaks of such an experience being caught up in the third heaven in 2 Corinthians, where he says, I was snatched up to paradise to hear words which cannot be uttered, words which no man can speak. So he was given a knowledge of God that he cannot explain, that he cannot describe. And it's kind of what Teresa talks about here too. She receives the knowledge but doesn't know how it happens or can't explain how it happens. And the idea that God always does something for a purpose, never does anything without a purpose, is something that I think about a lot. I guess a lot of people, you know, think about that a lot too. Is he never does anything haphazardly. He never does anything just for kicks.
So why did he repeat these experiences for her, for other saints throughout life? What would the purpose be?
Because each time he tells you more about himself.
And you grow in love.
And you grow in love for him. You grow in knowledge of him. Mm-hmm. And then for people like Teresa, who was in charge of all these nuns, she could then teach more about him to these nuns to help them love him more. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, a good thing. And then, of course, when she writes it down like she did, it helps us understand God more and love him more. I was thinking about that when I was reading the Litany of the Precious Blood. And when you look through the different, you know, they got these different statements as you go through the litany. And the things that caught my attention were the blood of Christ falling upon the earth at the crucifixion. A blood of Christ falling from your crown, you know, etc. They got two or three statements where it talks about his blood falling upon the earth. So why would he do that? Why would he let his blood go into the earth? It's got to be a reason. Because his blood is what gives life. He tells us in Leviticus that all blood is what gives life to the body. And all life belongs to me. So in other words, blood belongs to me. So he tells the people, you can't have blood. You got to bleed something completely before you're allowed to eat it. And then you take the blood and you offer it up in the temple with the high priest. And I couldn't get that out of my mind. Mm. So I wrote this little prayer on the blood of Christ falling upon the earth in different places throughout his passion. And then let your precious blood move through the entire earth and sanctify the entire earth and stuff. So if you want that, I'll send it to you.
That'd be nice. Yeah.
What is in that book about the flame of love?
Yeah.
Christ makes the statement that you can draw upon his blood. How do you do that?
Prayer. You do the prayer. If you look at the chaplet of the precious blood, it goes through there. It talks about each one of his wounds and the blood that comes from them. And you meditate on the pain that they caused. But each one has something that says, because of this, do the following thing. It's like ask him to do certain things for us. One is to keep the spirits of the devil away from us, especially at the hour of our death. And so each one of the five wounds, there's a petition attached to it as a result of his precious blood. And you ask for that. And then throughout, after each one of the mysteries, it's, you say, precious blood of Jesus, save us and the whole world. And you do that 12 times. Yeah. Again, 12, you see that so much in Scripture. You know, 12 apostles, 12 tribes of Egypt, of Israel, and stuff like that.
And as an aside, in that book, Mary says that one Hail Mary said was referenced to the flame of love gets, during the month of November, gets 12 souls into heaven, free from purgatory.
Yeah. It's a good thing.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So all this, all these things that are just different ways God draws us to himself, shares his love with us, but also tries to teach us about himself so that we can love him more. And this is the betrothal stage, you know. So in that betrothal stage, that's where you're engaged to get married, you're growing in love for each other, but you're also learning more about each other because you talk a lot. You don't just say, well, we're engaged now, but I'll see you in 6 months, you know. You're there almost every day together, and you talk and you talk and you talk and you learn about each other so that you communicate yourself to the other. You tell the other person, you know, what you believe about this, about that, or how you feel about this, or how you feel about that. The one question you always ask is, how many kids do you want, you know? That's always one that people forget to ask, but that's an important question. And so all these things are very important. And so it's getting to know. Well, that's the same thing that's happening here. And the only way we can get to know God more is when he shares himself with us. Because we can't go into him and do that. You know, he's got to do that for us. And so that's what's happening in this betrothal stage. All these different experiences, these raptures and these intellectual visions and all, they're all ways that God uses to communicate himself to us. And that's, you know, always for our benefit. So Teresa does not indicate she was told any purpose. So we wonder, well, what was the purpose of this? Well, it's to know God better and to love him more. That it happened many times is clear from her saying at the beginning. And so this must have happened often, and we are hopeful that she will tell us why as the description unfolds. In her case, the rapture is of the spirit only, not of both body and spirit. And then if you go to page 298 in the book, she's got a description of her experience. And if this happened to you, do you think at this stage of your spiritual development, you would assume it is God acting and not some nefarious agent? I think so.
Yes.
Yeah. Because the result of it is that it makes you love him more. The devil is never going to do anything to you to help you love God more. So that's a first big indicator. You know, if you come out of this experience loving God more, you know it's from him. Because if it's not from him, when you come out of the experience, you are unsettled. You have anxiety. You know, something does not sit right. You're disturbed. You know, all those kind of things. In section 2, Teresa explains the futility of trying to resist this and says the soul should trust in God and be entirely docile to whatever he is doing with the soul. Teresa describes it like a huge wave of water lifting up the soul, and she says here the soul doesn't care what happens in the exterior senses. So she doesn't really care what's happening to your sense of smell, taste, and everything else. All she cares about is what's happening between you and God. In section 4, she exclaims how amazed she was at the immense power of God in doing this with the soul. She says, if his majesty, there's a typo there, should be his, if his majesty were to reveal this power to those who go astray in the world, as he does to these souls, the former would not dare offend him, this out of fear, if not out of love.
Think he should do that.
Yeah, well, that's the question. From what Jesus says, why do you think God does not grant this grace to souls who go astray? After all, he wants all of us to love him and go to heaven.
Unless he knows they won't pay attention to it.
He doesn't want us to love him out of fear. That's the big clue she gives us here. She says, if he does these souls, the former would not dare offend him, but this out of fear, if not out of love. She wants everything we do to him to be based on love, not fear. That's the big clue there. Because love is the one that, well, God, you know, John tells us in his letters that God is love. So when we encounter him, we encounter the essence of love. And so everything we do with God has to be motivated by love. It's got to be the thing for everything. So when you go to confession, you know, when you see the act of contrition, you talk about, you know, the fear of hell and all, but most of all because they offend you. And that's the real thing. You know, we don't want to offend God because we love him. Not because we're afraid he's going to slap us upside the head or something. Yeah. And that's the important thing. Okay, it is 10:35. We will stop here and pick up with 6, 5, 5, 6, and 7 next time. And I will print out my copy again. Give this back to whoever this belongs to.
As a youth.
Okay, any thoughts before we leave?
I wonder if the warning is going to be like this for us.
The warning is probably going to be much different.
Okay.
If you look at with this, at least from what I've read, okay, we haven't had it yet, so I can't really say from experience, but if you what you read about the warning, it says that you just find some place, just be by yourself, have a candle, have a blessed candle lit, and it'll last as long as for the whole 3 days, and just close all your windows and doors, and don't try to do anything except pray, and just let whatever's happening, don't open the doors or windows to anything. You'll hear voices that sound like your relatives begging you to come in. Please open the door, let us in, we're scared, you know, this kind of thing. Don't pay attention to that. Don't listen to anything external.
Also, it's nice to be home when the warning comes.
Yeah.
I mean, God help us if I'm out driving someplace. Or what do you do when you're driving a car?
I don't need it.
Well, is the warning
I've got it at home.
A 3 day of darkness, or the 2 separate
events? Somebody would need one.
I thought it was
okay.
Separate.
It's not yours?
Well,
I have
one, and I don't know where that one came from.
You got it, too?
So
okay.
Countdown to the Kingdom.
Not clear cut.
The latest message from November 5th.
But all those things, that they said that after it's over, a lot of people are going to be dead. Because Satan's going to be here. The devil's going to be coming across.
No.
Yeah.
And just hunker down and trust God and just pray.
There's something on TV, some preacher, and he wrote a book about the rapture.
Yeah, they've been advertising on television.
And they're showing it would scare people out of their wits. I mean, they're showing people doing ordinary things, and all of a sudden, one person vanishes and goes up. Then there's going to be chaos in the world, and the world is going to be crazy. What?
They're not going to have it in rapture. It's a bad theology.
That's crazy to be on.
Well, it's also very recent. You know, and there are Protestant seminaries where you have to believe in the rapture to even be a teacher at the cemetery.
We never learned.
But it's really bad theology. And if you guys want to do a session like this on the rapture, one time we can do that if you're interested. I've got some really good books on it, so we can use them.
Back when I was in my 20s, I was involved in a convention that was teaching.
Yeah.
And they were teaching that they could teach you to levitate
and
disappear.
Really?
And I guess they figured it worked. They haven't seen me in 4 years.
Normal people are saying that. I go, would it be dead bad if I got a lot of tuna?
I don't want to class on that.
Yeah. No. So glad.
Okay, so we will see you next week.
Yeah.
Thank you for.